You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And we are joined by Daniele Friberincini.
Hello, chaps.
Is that catching on or not?
No, few more that weeks. Was me sounding. I know you can't see me, but that was me sounding unimpressed.
Nonplussed.
Very much unimpressed.
You're in. Well, are you in a secret location, Daniel, or are you?
No. I mean, the Stasi were taken out of service a few years ago, Rich. I'm in Berlin, and everyone is allowed to know about it.
Great. Well, we're in the South Bank. There were helicopters last week and skateboards today. Lionel, do the UCI have jurisdiction on skateboards? They were arguing about that, weren't they?
They were. A few years ago, weren't they? The UCI felt that skateboarding should come under their auspices. And I remember a colleague of mine joking whether wheeled suitcase racing would also come under the UCI regulations, seeing as they were trying to claim that anything that didn't have a motor but which had wheels should be
governed. And yet they're also
now the UCI
trying to govern bikes with motors as
they
well.
They are.
So,
yeah.
Wow, careful there, Richard. With motors?
Careful there, Richard. They check the bikes very carefully with an iPad to make sure there's no motors in
them. You know perfectly well what I'm talking about, Lionel, e-bikes. But anyway, the big news this week is the announcement today. We're speaking on Tuesday. Announcement this morning of the Tour de France route for 2020. We'll be talking about that in this episode. We'll also be looking back on Il Lombardia at the weekend, maybe Paris Tour as well. We're going to hear from Egan Bernal, who I went to interview last week just before Il Lombardia. But before we crack on with any of that, we want to give an early shout out for our tour, our own Grand Tour, next month. It starts on November the 11th in Bristol. And we haven't actually confirmed to date our lineup for our shows. So for the first week of the shows, that's Bristol on the 11th of November, then Cardiff, Worcester, Dublin and Belfast. It's going to be myself, Lionel Burney, Orla Chinoui, making a triumphant homecoming to Belfast, no doubt, and Francois Tomazo. Then the next batch of shows, which there are two in London, and then where do we go after London? Cambridge,
Edinburgh, Leicester and Manchester.
That's right. That will be me, Lionel and Daniele Friberincini.
So that'll be the A team is what you're trying to say. The big guns coming in for the second half.
Yeah, well, you could put it like that. I mean, we'll probably present it slightly differently when we're doing the podcast with Francois and Orla. but we're going to have one or two special guests as well, which we'll announce next week. But tickets are still available. One or two shows very close to selling out, in particular Belfast and Edinburgh. But go to thecyclingpodcast.com and click on live events to get your tickets and try and get them before we announce our special guests next week for one or two of the shows. The tour coincides with the publication of our second book, The Grand Tour Diaries, which will be out in early November. And if you come to the show, you can get it at a discounted price. So that's that's just gone away to the printers and very exciting. I've been reading it the last few days. You've been reading it as well, Lionel, I think.
I've been chortling at my own jokes, Richard, as you would no doubt expect.
No less. Yes, well, anyway, all that. So you can also, I think, buy the book before coming to the show and pick it up at the show, and we'll have a system for that
in place by next week, hopefully. But yeah, sort of click and collect type system. We're very modern, aren't we? You can buy it in advance and just collect it on the night, just to make it easy, I guess.
And I mean, just a little footnote to that is that Stacey Snyder, the ceramicist who made these beautiful mugs for us all this year, she emailed me the other day. And she has booked a flight over from Washington to London to come to the show on the 25th of November. She's coming for 3 days. She's going to pack in a few museums and art galleries in London. But that's going to be delightful. We've met her before. We're going to go out for lunch with her and meet her properly. And she added a lot to the experience of doing the podcast this year. And I know a lot of you are proud owners of the Cycling Podcast mugs. So We'll be looking forward to meeting her at one of the shows.
Pressure's on there, isn't it? Just knowing somebody's coming all the way from the US of A to come and see us. We better be good that night. We'll be good every night, though, won't we? Hopefully.
That's the plan, Lionel. Do we have a news roundup at all, Lionel?
Indeed. Well, you mentioned Il Lombardia, the final monument of the season, and Bauke Mollema's first monument. We'll talk about that in which part did we decide? The second part?
The part after we do the Tour de France.
Right. So we'll talk about Bauke Mollema's win and, the tactics of the riders in the chase group behind. The following day, Paris-Tours was won by Yellow Wallace of Lotto Soudal. It's the second time he's won Paris-Tours. He's also won the under-23 edition in the past. Really entertaining couple of hours racing, I thought, watching them go through the vineyards on the gravelly tracks. Nicky Terpstra was second, his first big result since crashing out of the Tour de France in July, and Oliver Narsen with third. We posed the question last week whether anyone would ride both Il Lombardia and Paris-Tours, and well, Roy Sutherland completed Il Lombardia on Saturday and then took a late flight from I think Milan to Paris and then got himself down to Chartres for the start on Sunday morning because UAE Team Emirates needed him to reach the minimum five starters for the race, and being the kind of the old man of the team, perhaps the one who might complain the least, he had the job of riding two difficult races back to back. He didn't finish Paris-Tours because he crashed in the fairly early on in the race. The build-up races to Il Lombardia continued. This stretch of one-day races has really kind of captured the imagination in the past couple of years. Michael Woods won Milano-Torino and Egan Bernal won Gran Piemonte, and obviously they were in the final shake-up on Saturday as well. Last week we were talking about the Grand Prix Bruno Beghelli, and Rob Taylor writes to say that Bruno Beghelli is a local businessman based in Montevello, a town outside Bologna, which is where the race is, starts and finishes, and they're an electrical company. They make electrical things, so that solves the mystery of who Bruno Beghelli was. I was racking my brains thinking, was it a winner of the Giro from the very early days or something? But no, he's a businessman who sponsors the race. Also some racing in France. Marc Sarreau, who won the Tour de Vendée last week, added Paris-Bourges, and Dylan Groenewegen won the Tax Pro Classic, also known as the Ronde van Zeeland in the Netherlands. Now, three of the greats from the 60s and 70s, Eddie Merckx, Ramon Poulidor and Roger de Vlaeminck, have all had spells in hospital. Eddie Merckx crashed while riding his bike in Belgium on Sunday and has sustained a head injury and has been kept in for observation. Ramon Poulidor has been in hospital as well, 83 years old. He's been not feeling his best since July, apparently, where he works at the Tour as a an ambassador
yeah,
for Credit Lyonnais, the bank that sponsors the yellow jersey. He's of course the grandfather of Mathieu van der Poel, and Roger de Vlaeminck's been in hospital with a fever as well. So, best wishes to all of them as they are on the road to recovery. That's about it for the news roundup, other than the big news, which is the Tour de France route launch and the very early bid by Chris Froome to get one up on Egan Bernal by saying that Bernal's told him already that he's going to support Froome at the 2020 Tour de France.
Well, just before we go on to that, Lionel, you mentioned Michael Woods' win at Milano-Torino. We watched that last week, and I had a quick word with him at the start of Il Lombardia, just to ask him what that victory meant.
Yeah, I actually talked to Stephen Ferrand, I think, the day before in an interview, talking about how I've missed some opportunities with wins because I was, I try and win in a certain way. I don't like sitting back. I like being aggressive. And to have won in an aggressive fashion like that was special for me.
Do you enjoy these races this week?
I love these races. They're so dynamic. I like the circuits. I like how interesting and intriguing the courses are. And for me, I'm far better when I'm engaged the entire time instead of riding on this flat road. I love it when there's constant undulation, constant turning. I really thrive in those environments, and that's why I really like these races.
And a really nice way to finish the season, I guess. You finish with a win, and you go into the winter feeling probably pretty happy with your season, do you?
Yeah, I think I was pretty satisfied with the season prior to these races. I wasn't ecstatic just because I didn't have a big win, but now I consider Milan Torino a big win, and I can finish the season quite content. The rest now, today, and even Japan Cup, is just, if I get a result at those races, it'll be icing on the cake.
You regard it then as a sort of more progress this year, another step forward?
Yeah, I think winning at the Vuelta was a big accomplishment. Coming third at the World Championships was a big accomplishment, but I still hadn't beaten the best guys on the day in a one-day race. And although it wasn't a monument, Milano Torino, like, you look at the field and it was a World Tour race. Just the quality field, and the guy that was second is Alejandro Valverde. So to have won finally at that level, I think is a step up.
And looking ahead to next year, what are you thought already about what your goals might be next year?
I'm already looking towards next year for sure. I think the Olympics is a huge goal for me, particularly just because I come from an athletics background. I really hold the Olympics in high regard. And also the World Championships, if you look at that course, it really suits me. So two big targets for me next year are going to be those races.
The fastest clothing in the World Tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Ratha in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Yes, thank you very much indeed to our title sponsor, Ratha. And we heard from a man in Ratha just before the break there, Michael Woods, the EF Education First rider, who, Lombardia didn't go quite so well for him, but he won, as he said there, very pleased indeed to take his first sort of big one-day race in Milano-Torino. But the big news today and this week, earlier than usual, the announcement of the Tour de France route for next year. It is earlier, I think. And I was told by somebody, I don't know if this is true or not, that one of the reasons might have been because Egan Bernal was still in Europe, and this might have been the last chance to get him. The route itself, we'll talk about that, but I'm always interested to watch the presentation, which doesn't really change. It's always in the same place, but the way that they use the riders and introduce the riders, there are subtle changes to that every year. We always look with interest at what the riders are wearing. Thibaut Pinot's white shoes with his white trainers with his suit, what did we think of that? Romain Bardet, a very relaxed look for Romain Bardet. I mean, Daniel, you're our kind of fashionista. What did you make of the riders' outfits?
To be honest, I haven't seen them all. I saw a few pictures. I saw a few descriptions of them looking, they looked as though they'd, you know, turned up for their first work experience day out of sixth form college. I could see where people were coming from. I saw that Egan Bernal had a natty handkerchief. He was looking quite elegant. Romain Bardet, he's a bit too young to be kitted out in a sort of beige brown turtleneck. I mean, it's the kind of look that I could pull off, but I'm not sure about Romain Bardet. I mean, I know his Tour de France career, it's not on the trajectory that he would like it to be on, but he's still, you know, he's in his 20s.
Yeah.
He doesn't need to go off delivering milk tray just yet.
Chris Froome has smartened up his act. He looked quite smart today, I thought. But I was quite impressed with the way that Bernal sort of came on stage last, and the way that he sort of addressed the crowd and the way he carried himself. I thought for a 22-year-old, obviously a Tour de France winner, but he did that pretty well, I thought. Gave a big sort of quite a bow to the crowd and got a great response. But that's not the important business, of course, how the riders looked. The important business is what they will be riding next year. Every year, they say it's the hardest route ever. Or, you know, it seems to be... last year was the highest ever. This year, it's not certainly not the longest ever. Quite short stages. And the main talking point is probably the time trial on the penultimate day to La Planche des Belles Filles, which will not go along the dirt road that they went along to finish the stage this year, but will finish at the more familiar finish that we've had the last few years. That's the main thing. That's the only time trial in the race. Early mountain stages, but a lot for the sprinters as well. I mean, what are your first impressions, Daniel?
Well, Rich, the first impression when you look at the route is that it's more... I've just said to someone on Twitter, it's more Biggie than Tupac. It's more Tupac than Biggie. It's more South than North. It's more chocolatine than pain au chocolat. You get that reference, Napalm?
Yeah,
we do actually. Yeah,
do you? Mm-hmm. So in the South, yeah, there are big areas of the South where pain au chocolat is known as a chocolatine. Apparently,
where were we with Francois when that was the case? It was the day you went to meet Jonathan Vaughters.
Where was that?
Southwest. It would have been
it
probably
was a southwest.
Somewhere.
Southwest.
Yeah. Well, you were. It was around Albi. The stage had finished in Albi the previous day.
Yeah, but less sort of frivolously, facetiously, I would say that a couple of people have referred to the tours. Vueltification, and I would say that's pretty accurate, both in the sense that the stages are noticeably shorter than usual, or I think there's only one stage above 200 kilometers. Also, we've talked a lot in this year's Vuelta about how it was difficult to sort of orientate oneself because there were no sort of noticeable big blocks in a single range of mountains. The sort of mountains were sprinkled throughout the race, and that is the case in this Tour de France. The route is going to visit all five of the main massifs in France, so Alps, Pyrenees, Jura, the Massif Central, and the Vosges, not in that order. But it'll be broken up very quickly, probably from the first day. There are the hills on the first stage, certainly on the second stage, there are some quite big hills, some big climbs. That might lead to the sort of peloton settling down, being a bit less stressed, maybe fewer crashes. That's at least been the conventional wisdom for a few years now, that a route like this would have that kind of effect. In that sense, it might suit someone like Thibaut Pinot, who I noticed in his comments about the route, well, he seems delighted. But, he'll be happy that the sort of cream rises to the top quite quickly. There'll be maybe less sort of fighting for position among the GC guys on the flatter stages. On the other hand, though, mentally, it might make it even more taxing because... again, much as was the case during the Vuelta, it's difficult to look at the route and just say, right, that's a GC day, that's a GC day, and then we've got five when all we have to do is sort of rest in the bunch, and then we'll sort of fight it out again. It's pretty much, looking at the route, something could happen almost every day. And that, as I say, for someone like Pino, who up until, 2.5 weeks of the 2.5 weeks of this year's tour had struggled to really put all 3 weeks together, might be a bit of a concern. There are a lot of days there that have to be negotiated, a lot of time when a rider's going to have to be at peak fitness and not get ill, not crash, and not come unstuck in some other way.
Just on that opening weekend, I mean, it's a flat stage. It's described as a flat stage, stage one. It's quite hard, but we imagine that would be a sprinter's day. But stage two, how similar is it? I think it's harder than the traditional final day of Paris-Nice, but it also uses a circuit, so they're going to be doing some laps of Nice at the end, and that could be a really interesting day. It reminds me a bit of the 92 Tour de France, which started in San Sebastian, and day two we had a mountain stage already, and you saw the big guns then, Indurain, Bugno, Chiappucci, all kind of on the front and riding away. And that's interesting from the point of view too of riders sort of being in form for the whole 3 weeks and being on it for 3 weeks. I mean, do you know at this stage how hard that second stage is?
It's difficult, Rich, at the moment, just to assess the difficulty of all the stages because there aren't many of the climb profiles available. But those two climbs, what's the first one? Is it the Colmian and the Turini are, they're big climbs. I mean, they're longish climbs, not terribly steep, and they're a long way from the finish. But they come early in the stage, and then got the Col d'Aise, and as you say, a sort of fairly traditional looking route into Nice. But I think something will happen as far as general classification is concerned. There will certainly be some skirmishes. I mean, the sort of trajectory of that early part of the race reminds me a little bit of 2009 when it started in Corsica. The difference being that whereas
Monaco.
Sorry, 2000. No, Corsica.
Oh, and 13.
Yeah. When the difference being that in 2013 the sort of race forked left and hugged the coast and sort of went to the Pyrenees that way, whereas next year it's going to turn inland and it's going to head into sort of some even more mountainous terrain and into the bottom half of the Alps. And there's a first summit finish at Orcières, Miaulet on stage 4, and then there's another mountaintop finish at Mont Aiguille on stage 6, and that's all before the race gets to the Pyrenees. So I mean, I think as far as first weeks are concerned, it's probably the most mountainous we've ever seen.
I think the uphill, there's an uphill finish at Privas as well, isn't there, on stage 5.
Correct.
So actually three sort of pretty tricky days in a row. Orcières Miaulet is one of those places that just stands out to me because it was the place during the 1989 Tour de France where Stephen Rooks won the mountain time trial there, and Greg LeMond took the yellow jersey back, and that's always stuck in my mind. But that first week, and in fact the whole tour really, looks to me to be almost a sort of tour detention. It's not, there's no real kind
copyright
of,
line on,
well,
Bernie.
It's stressed from day one all the way through that first week, really. Everyone will be looking at stage 7 to be the now traditional, the one to Lavaur, the now traditional boring flat stage that Dylan Groenewegen wins on the first Friday of the tour. That's now happened since records began, I think. It certainly feels like that anyway after the last 2 years. And then it's kind of quick slow again, isn't it, with the mountains being broken up by stages that may or may not cause difficulty. I think the one to Ile de Ré, well, if the wind blows there off the Atlantic, you know, that's been put in there to cause mischief rather than anything else.
And
it looks
beautiful.
Spectacular.
It's the island to island stage. I think the first time that's ever been done. The tour's never been to Ile de Ré before, I don't believe.
Napalm, you mentioned Groenewegen and Jumbo Visma. I mean, it's the kind of route and the kind of first week where you think that a team that is coming in with multiple objectives and is coming in or thinks they might come in with a sprinter and general classification riders might actually think twice about taking their sprinter. I'm thinking particularly about Jumbo Visma. We know that Dumoulin is joining them, and he's going to be, well, he'll have looked at with interest at the route today. They've also got Roglic, of course, Kreiswijk, but they also have Mike Teunissen and Wout van Aert, who showed in this year's tour they can win stages in sprints, and they can also probably do more of a job for a general classification rider than Dylan Groenewegen. And I just wonder whether a rider like that might find his position in there in the starting lineup slightly imperiled on a route like this.
That's a very good point, but one that we probably won't know the answer to until we see the roots of the Giro and perhaps to a lesser extent the Vuelta as well. But that's always the thing with the tour route, isn't it? The sort of knee-jerk snap judgment on the day the route is announced ranges from it's the best tour ever to it's the worst tour ever. And it's a funny one, this. I can't quite get a handle on what it is, because it isn't peppered with kind of famous summit finishes, really. There's a few interesting new ones. The Col de la Loze will be really interesting. That's pretty high, 2,300 metres. The final 6 kilometres are on a car-free road. So that
on what looks like beautiful new tarmac, and it connects Méribel and Courchevel, doesn't it? I've skied there, and you know the roads connections weren't great, so I was interested to see this new climb.
A finish on the Grand Colombier just before that as well, that will be interesting. And then the stage which goes over the Corme de Roseland, the Col de Saisy, and also the Plateau des Glières, which is where, well, that was on the route when Julian Alaphilippe won a stage a couple of years ago, and it's a sort of Alaphilippe Pinot route, isn't it?
I was going to say.
From yeah. start to finish.
Francois will roll his eyes at that. But.
Yeah, especially with the time trial on La Planche de Belfie, which again, it's a familiar road, but being a time trial, well, we've never seen that before, so we don't know what impact that will have, whether that will lead to a kind of cagey, cautious race because everyone will wait for the time trial at the end, or whether it will have the complete opposite effect. I mean, at the moment, we really are in sort of guesswork territory. But I like the look of it. I like the fact that the first sort of proper mountain stage is not the first climbing as well. I think that's something that we haven't really seen in recent years. The one to Orsier Merlet won't be the first time they go uphill, so it won't be that sort of shock to the system, perhaps. So we could see quite a racy first week.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
We've been interrupted there by Seb Piquet, the voice of Race Radio at the Tour de France, of course, and that's to remind me to tell you that this week's episode is sponsored by Laka, returning Laka. Lionel, what can you tell us about Laka?
Well, Rich, Laka is a smarter way of insuring your bikes and gear. It's a community of cyclists joining together to play fair and take good care in order to save each other money. Laka covers all the basics you'd expect: theft, accidental loss and damage, both at home and abroad. And it also covers you in sportives and races, as long as you're not riding in the pro peloton. They're not going to start insuring the World Tour teams. Instead of charging you a fixed premium, you only pay a small share of the community's claim costs, and your share is proportionate to how much you insure yourself with Laka. So while your share can theoretically go down to £0 if there are no claims in a particular month, Laka also locks in a maximum price to ensure that there are no nasty surprises, even in months when there are lots of claims. Claims are accepted quickly, usually within a day. But don't take our word for it. Let's hear from one of Laka's customers who had to make a claim while riding his bike on holiday.
I've travelled a lot over the last year internationally with my bike. I took it to my wife's chagrin on every holiday I went on and spent a lot of time cycling. I'm Philip Meyer. I've been a Laka customer since April 2018. I tried to ride about 150 to 200 kilometres a week. I went out on actually what turned out to be the longest cycle I've ever done. Well, it was the longest at the time. About halfway through the 150k ride, the third party mount that I had for my cycling computer broke for no apparent reason. My cycling computer flew into the air, catapulted along and landed on the floor and just smashed into pieces. So I was pretty distraught, mainly actually about the fact that it wasn't going to record my ride rather than the fact that that it was broken. But it was a pretty expensive piece of kit, so I followed up with Laka that afternoon. I used their app, then actually followed up with them on the phone because I wasn't quite sure what to do. I had a brilliant experience. I can't say how positive and helpful they were. And I told them that, you know, I was away cycling. I needed this. There's no way I could survive without a cycling computer. And so I went to the shop the next day and just bought a replacement. I mean, it was expensive, 590 quid, I think it cost. Sent them the receipt. I mean, I was really surprised because the money was back in my account by the time I went to bed that evening. And actually, I'd sent them the receipt. I'd also bought a pair of socks I couldn't resist. And they paid me back for the socks as well as a way of sort of sympathizing with me, I guess. Anyway, so it was a really positive experience. They were so friendly, so helpful. And I was just stunned, having had other insurance claims in the past, which took forever and where you almost made feel like a criminal. These guys were just positive, friendly, and went out of their way to help me, you know. And it was an expensive piece of kit, so it would have been a pain on holiday to have been short of that money.
Laka's members have saved 61% on their bike insurance, and that's money that could be spent on a new piece of kit or put towards a training camp or a cycling holiday. So if you want to find out more about Laka, go to laka.co.uk. that's laka.co.uk.
just carrying on with the route of the tour next year, much was made of the fact there's only one time trial in the race, but it's quite a long time trial. I mean, everybody again is talking about the climb up to La Planche des Belles Filles. But 36 kilometres starting from your favourite town, Lionel, Lure.
Yeah,
the scene of a famous barbecue a couple of years ago,
where the man with a missing finger offered us a barbecue and we declined it and went into town and had a very average meal.
Well, we declined it on the basis that you believed that he must have chopped off his finger preparing our meat, and that you weren't prepared to eat a barbecued finger. So we missed out on that. But starting in Lure, finishing at La Planche des Belles Filles, and it's a gamble, isn't it, by the organisers? It's a gamble because that will be really exciting if the race is still very close. But as we saw at La Planche des Belles Filles, admittedly with the extra bit tacked on this year, it's a tough climb, And it's going to be hard for riders to really know how to judge that effort. It's also the longest individual time trial in the Tour since 2016, when Tom Dumoulin won the long time trial. And I think he will look at that time trial with some relish. The climb as well, I think, suits him.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, Rich. But it's not just a long time trial, is it? It's a mountain time trial. It's a proper mountain time trial. We haven't seen a real proper mountain time trial for how long?
Alpe d'Huez, Armstrong, 2000 and what year was that? Five, four,
yeah.
Four.
There's been sort of uphill time trials and very difficult time trials, but on a proper kind of category one or bigger climb, we haven't really seen that for a long time, and so that will be interesting. It's almost like the sort of the cork in the bottle of champagne. The thing is whether or not the race dislodges the cork over the 3 weeks enough that we might get a real explosion of fizz on that final Saturday, or whether it's a bit of a, well, we don't see any bubbles because the cork remains firmly lodged in the bottle because the race is done and dusted. I mean, I look at that stage 19 to Champagnole the day before, the sort of sprint stage just stuck in there between two mountain tests. Obviously, that's something we've talked about, the way that in recent years it seemed that the tour route has sought to kind of unsettle the rhythm for riders. So they go from riding big gears one day, small gears the next day, climbing, then flat, then climbing again. And that's the sort of thing that some riders don't respond too well to. And it might lead to quite an interesting final time trial. But if the race is done and dusted going into that Friday, that's the sort of stage where everyone feels a slightly deflated, don't they? But, I mean, we just don't know. There's so much that could happen. And I think, you know, rather than... you know, I think this is probably as close to the kind of the fantasy medium challenge of the Tour de France as we're realistically likely to get.
Lionel.
Not sure about that, but Julian Alaphilippe could.
Well, we're going to hear actually from the defending champion, the winner of this year's Tour de France, Egan Bernal, and Chris Froome, both at the presentation in Paris today. Francois Thomazeau was there, and he sent us a couple of clips from both of them reacting to the route. Let's hear from Bernal first. He's asked initially what he thinks of the course, and then we'll hear from Chris Froome. It's Seb Piquet asking him the questions, and Froome starts off talking about how he's getting on in his convalescence after his crash earlier this year at the Dauphiné Libéré.
To be honest, I don't remember too much because it was too fast, but so far I think that will be really hard. It's an atypical course without the team time trial and with just one time trial, and the final is in uphill, really steep. So it will be like a little bit different. But yeah, I really like, and I think that the people also will like, because I think that will give a lot of emotions with the steep climbs and with attacks. So I think that will be great for the people. I am a climber, so I prefer to have this kind of stages. Like I said before, I really like the percourse, and yeah, I think that will be a different tour, really really hard with the steep climb. So yeah, we'll see what happens.
Doing much better, thanks. Doing much better. I'm on the road to recovery still. I've made it back onto the bike in this last month, which has been fantastic. Still a little bit shaky on my feet, but heading in the right direction. I've still got a plate on my hip that I need to get removed soon. And once that comes off, hopefully things will start to improve a little bit faster.
And already focused on the Tour de France. A word on that course that you just discovered.
Yeah, I mean that course for next year is brutal. It's probably the hardest tour route I've seen in the last 5-6 years. A lot of climbing elevation meters. A lot of opportunities, really, is the way I see it. A lot of opportunities for the general classification to play out. So, should be a really exciting tour. And then, obviously, with the sting in the tail on stage 20, with the time trial, 36-kilometer time trial finishing up La Planche de Belleville, it's just going to be. I mean, we haven't seen anything like that for decades.
And you'll be at home at the beginning. That's also a bonus for you.
Yeah, I mean, starting on roads that we're really familiar with around Nice, fantastic for us. And and the team, and certainly looking forward to being there.
And many options within the team. You, of course, the title holder, Geraint Thomas. That's also fantastic for the team, but it's a bit tricky.
I mean, we've got an amazing lineup, amazing roster of riders to select from. So I mean, nothing's decided yet. I mean, for me personally, I've obviously got to get myself back to that level before even discussing leadership or anything like that. But at least for now, everything's headed in the right direction, and we're optimistic.
So that was Egan Bernal, the winner of this year's Tour, and Chris Froome, the four-time winner of the Tour. And Froome not being drawn there on the question of who will lead the team, although there have been stories already, and this will be a recurring theme over the next few months, about who will lead the team. I mean, Bernal, I mean, I asked him about this as well when I met him last week. We're going to hear from him again a little bit later in the episode, but that's for an interview that you'll hear later on. Bernal, you know, is clearly in pole position, and Froome will have to prove that he is capable of riding at that level again, won't he?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's quite a comeback, isn't it, to be off, out of competition. Say Froome comes back in February or March, that's a three quarters of a year out of action, isn't it? So yeah, a lot to prove before he even gets back into racing, really.
Well, Lionel, as well as the route presentation today in Paris, a big day for the Tour de France today because our road trip is released. Now, during this year's Tour, we recorded bits and pieces as we went from our live show in Brussels all the way through to Paris, various meandering off-piste conversations between you, me, and Francois Thomazeau. We weren't travelling with Daniel, sadly, of course, but we recorded a lot of material, and it's a two-part Friends special that is being released to coincide with the announcement of the 2020 route.
Yes, well, not a lot of cycling chat in the road trip, really, is it?
There's a bit.
I don't want to put people off. I mean, or maybe it will entice people to listen. But we talk about lots of other things that are, well, everything kind of related to the experience of covering the Tour de France and travelling around France. And, well, I guess it's kind of like eavesdropping on us in the cycling podcast Team Car and around the dinner table.
I mean, you're a very humble man, Lionel, and I know you don't want to big up your ability to impersonate others, but your Alex Dowsett impression is wonderful. And there's another impression as well. I can't remember. Who else do you do? I've forgotten now.
Let the listeners discover this.
Alex Dowsett as Adam Buxton's dog Rosie is just quite...
Don't stitch me up.
You have to listen to that. It's great. Listen, just before we stop talking about the Tour de France route, one word about La Course, which goes back to Paris next year. There was quite a lot of talk in the preamble to the presentation about women's cycling and how ESO were committed to it. And there were quite a few female riders there. I noticed Cecilia Utrip-Ludwig was there. She actually has just announced that she's riding for FDJ next year. She's moving from Bigla to FDJ. But going back to Paris, I think, is a bit of a backward step, because La Course, when they've taken it out, well, to Pau this year in particular, but also the stage last year that was won by Annemiek van Vleuten to Grand Bornand, that was fantastic. The editions that have been held on the Champs-Élysées are basically criteriums, and they're not great. They work for the sprinters, but it's a backward step. But on the other hand, ASO did tell Julien Preteau of Reuters this year at the Tour that they are looking to set up a standalone stage race for women at a time of year where it doesn't clash with the Tour de France. So we await news on that, and I think that would be a far more exciting development than whatever they do with La Course, because it's always going to be quite limited.
Yeah, but I think there's impatience about these plans, isn't there? And, well, I completely understand if ASO aren't ready to unveil anything at the moment, but it does feel a, as you say, it's a backward step. La Course in Paris is it's not quite after the Lord Mayor's show, is it? But it's pretty damn close to that. It's a shame. But you know, let's not prejudge. Let's wait and see what gets announced in the next few months. Hopefully,
the cycling podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
I am Egan Bernal. I ride for Team Ineos, and my favorite product of Science in Sport is the caffeine gel.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for supporting the cycling podcast. And we heard there from none other than defending Tour de France champion, the winner this year, Egan Bernal, telling us his favourite Science and Sport product. You can get 25% off your Science and Sport products for yourself at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That is SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com if, like Egan Bernal, you want to stock up on caffeine gels. Now, the big race at the weekend was Ile Lombardia on Saturday. Paris-Tours also on Sunday brought the kind of curtain down on the European road season. I was at the start of Ile Lombardia. I was out there doing some interviews, including with Bernal, and we'll hear a little bit from him again in a moment. But I couldn't go to the finish in Como, unfortunately, because I had to come home. But I was at the start of Lombardia, and I was able to watch the race as well. And it was a fascinating finale, really, wasn't it? Because Bauke Mollema, one of these riders who's won quite a lot in situations like that, he's pretty good when he gets away. Even if he looks ragged, he's pretty effective. And it was a classic case of one of the not really fancied riders sneaking away and all the favourites looking at each other to chase him back. And, you know, Bernal, Roglic, Valverde, they wouldn't have been able to get away in the way that Mollema did. You know, he used his sort of underdog status to get away, and then once he was away, he really took advantage of the hesitation and the games that were being played behind. So it was really fascinating, because you were watching it thinking, this guy's probably not the strongest guy in this race or the fastest, but he's playing his hand absolutely brilliantly, and the others are kind of throwing it away.
Do you think that was because the others would think, I'm not going to use my energy here chasing Bauke Mollema, because if I use my energy here and then Roglic goes, say, if that's what Valverde's thinking, then they basically wasted valuable energy at a crucial time in the race. It was the obvious thing for Mollema to do, get out in front and see whether anyone chased, knowing that if people bridged up to him, he might still have a second bite of the cherry. But he won the Clásica San Sebastián a few years ago in a very similar style, and his Tour de France stage win in 2017 was not dissimilar either. So, a dangerous man just to let off the leash there, and really it was that hesitation and the late reaction from Primoz Roglic, because if he'd gone even 15 minutes earlier, he might have had more of a chance of getting on terms, or at least forcing something else to happen to get on terms with Mollema. But once he was away and there was proper daylight, well, I don't think there was anyone would have been able to close the door, even if there had been a concerted chase behind.
I think we saw a bit of Roglic's sort of, I would almost call it naivety still. I mean, we know that he's relatively new to professional cycling still, although he's 29, he's only been a pro for 4 or 5 years, and also he hasn't contended for many one day races. But I think, you know, it was a classic example of there being a favourite that everyone has sort of acknowledged. He also had the strongest team, but he had the strongest team up until the very moment when his last domestique pulled off, and at that point it immediately became a very dangerous situation for him. It became almost an emergency, because all of a sudden he was surrounded by lots of single riders who didn't have teammates, but were not going to help with any chasing if someone like Mollema got away. So therefore Roglic was, you know, he was the man who was going to have to do that if an attack did go. And obviously if he had just chased on his own, which he was probably strong enough to do, then he was a sitting duck, and someone else would have gone and other riders would have sort of attacked him in flurries. So it was almost, I was sort of sitting watching it and as soon as he was isolated, as soon as I saw Roglic on his own, it was kind of like the Crystal Maze. If you used to watch that, it was kind of like get out straight away. He had to do something in that very moment. He couldn't leave it another sort of kilometre or so to make his move. And then when he did finally make his move, it was belated. It was it was it was 2 or 3 kilometers too late. And as you said, despite him being the strongest rider, you could see that with the attack that he did finally make on the other side of the Chiviglio. It was to no avail, really.
Yeah, I mean, when I think he was an outstanding favourite, really, for the race, wasn't he? People recognised that he was really in great form. He'd never won a one-day race before last week, and then he won two. So he went into Lombardia in great form and with a very strong team. And it was probably his presence in that group that helped Mollema, you know. And he is... There are a few riders in that category, I suppose, of riders who are consistently probably underestimated. And yet, as you say, Lionel, he's won some big races now. I think the stage in the Tour de France was in the Massif Central, wasn't it? It was the Roman Bardet stage a couple of years ago. Tough courses. You know, San Sebastian is a tough race as well. And, you know, you speak to Mollema, he will still tell you that he's a GC rider. And, you know, he finished... He was well up there on GC at the Giro this year, wasn't he?
Fifth, I think.
Fifth, yeah. So he's still... And I've asked him this myself, whether having won some big races, and you know, he won that stage at the Tour a couple of years ago because he'd fallen out of the GC picture. And I think it was after that. I said, you know, you clearly can win races. Do you not fancy doing that instead of riding for GC? But he was absolutely adamant that he sees himself first and foremost as a GC rider. And yet, now he's won a Monument, he's won San Sebastian. And, you know, it's one of these kind of decisions that you question a little bit.
He also finished third in the 2011 Vuelta this year, remarkably.
Oh, yeah, that's
of course,
right.
Yeah. Great result.
One of the notable aspects of last week's racing in Italy, though, all those beautiful kind of autumnal races, was the presence of all three Grand Tour winners from this year. Not only riding, but quite aggressive and factors in the race. We haven't seen that for a few years, but Roglic, obviously the winner of the Vuelta, Richard Carapaz, the winner of the Giro. It's not really done an awful lot since the Giro, admittedly. And Egan Bernal, who was third in Lombardia. Valverde was second. He won in Gran Piemonte last week as well, Bernal. And that was a race that was very dear to him because he used to live in that area when he first came over to Italy to ride for Gianni Savio's team. And I was curious about, well, him in particular, why he, as Tour de France winner, was still racing in October and why he targeted these races. So I spoke to him the day before Lombardia, and here's what he said.
It's very unusual for a Tour de France winner to still be racing. It hasn't happened in recent years. You've come out to Italy, you're riding all these one-day races, you won yesterday, you're riding Lombardia tomorrow. Was that a choice? Is that something that you wanted to do?
Yeah, sure. I try to continue training well in Colombia. Maybe not really, really focused like for the tour. But I still riding with the long trains and, like I said before, enjoying the bike. But not 100% for these races. But it was also thinking about the next year. I think that is good to finish the season in a good level and maybe not stop after the tour, because it's July and you need to. I think that for me it's better to still in the bike and continue racing, even if I'm not at my 100%, but just to continue and to stop. But for the next season, I think that it will be good that I finish the season at this level. And yeah, I'm not tired. I'm not suffering to arrive at this part of the season, racing or training. Just finish the season in a good performance for the next season.
And I mean, looking at your career as a whole, people tend to be
quite specialists. I mean, Vincenzo Nibali, who's here as well, is a rider who's won Grand Tours and one-day classics. Would you also like to win a variety of races? Would you like to try and win races like maybe Liège-Bastogne-Liège, Il Lombardia, as well as the Grand Tours?
Yeah, for sure I would like, but also I would like to win Paris-Roubaix, but for sure I will not. I think that, yeah, maybe in the future I could improve a little bit more this kind of races, but I think that what I saw this season is that I am a rider for the stage races, so I want to be focused on that and maybe to try to win again some big race like a Giro or Tour again or the Vuelta would be really nice, and to be focused on that, and then if I win one day race for sure it will be really nice and I will enjoy it, but like I say, I want to just be focused in the stage races.
And Olympic Games next year, is that a target for you?
I don't know. It's really difficult to me to arrive there and to win. Even to have a medal is difficult, but it's the Olympics, it's for the country. Maybe, yeah, if I am in a good level and if I can organize the season and if I can arrive there in a good level, for sure I will go there, and like in any race I will do my best and to try to do something, but it's difficult to me to win these kind of races.
So that was Egan Bernal, first Colombian winner of the Tour de France, of course. Part of a much longer interview that will be a Friends special next year. That should come out in January or February next year. But the revelation there that he wants to win Paris-Roubaix.
Good luck, Egan.
No, he doesn't really. He clarified that. But, you know, he clearly is looking on his career as being more than just the Tour de France. And, you know, he wanted to try and win Lombardia, given which I was surprised that he rode on Wednesday, Thursday and Saturday. Maybe didn't give himself the best chance, but he rode well on Saturday. And, you know, it's clearly a race that he can win. The other race at the weekend, though, was Paris Tour. And is it no longer a sprinter's race? Because for many years it was known as a sprinter's race. But with the addition of the dirt roads, maybe that's not the case anymore.
Well, I think that much is evident. It was like a spring classic held in the autumn, wasn't it? The gravelly
part
roads.
Of the fact there was no De Koenig Quick Step.
There weren't that. Well, that was what I was going to say, because there was a kerfuffle last year, wasn't there, with the addition of some of these farm tracks. Really, they're not really gravel roads, are they? Well, there's a mixture, but it's not quite like the white roads of the Strada Bianca race. It's much more of a sort of farm track type surface rather than gravel.
And De Koenig Quick Step last year had a lot of mechanical problems, and Patrick Lefebvre, watching the race at home, tweeted that they would never return to it. The real reason for all their mechanical problems, according to another team, was that De Koenig Quick Step had locked the keys for the equipment truck in the truck and couldn't recce the course and used the wrong tyres and the wrong pressures. That was the theory of another team that will remain nameless. But De Koenig Quick Step did have a lot of mechanical problems and punctures and so on. But we saw that at the weekend as well, didn't we? The defending champion, Søren Krogh Andersen, had a puncture, a very unfortunate moment for him when he was off the front.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult one, this, because visually it was fantastic to watch. It looked really good, and I thought if there was a stronger field, this has got the makings of a sort of a race. Oh, not on a par with Paris-Roubaix, but certainly more interesting than watching a sprinter's classic. And I suppose, well, the sprinters, they have quite a lot of opportunities in the Grand Tours, don't they? And I wonder whether as a televisual spectacle, whether other than sort of Milan-San Remo, which has got a lot more kind of nuance and interest to it, I wonder whether there's really a place at the end of the season when, you know, perhaps sort of TV viewers' enthusiasm is waning as the season winds down, whether, you know, there's really room for a race that, even with the insertion of some climbs as they did a sort of 5 or 6 years ago in the finale to sort of break it up, really Paris-Tours become a race to watch for sort of 15-20 minutes at the end, and this has totally changed that. On the other hand, Søren Kragh Andersen had a very badly timed puncture and couldn't get a proper service, and then made a big effort and then was passed by people, and his race was done and dusted. So, you know, there's quite a high level of lottery and luck in the parcours of Paris-Tours, but to write it off, as Johan Bruneel did on Twitter as well, I mean, I just think there's got to be room for something that's a little bit different, and there's nothing to say that Paris-Tours can't change its culture, absolutely entirely, if that's what the race organisers, in this case ASO, deem is in the best future health of the event.
Well, I think, Lionel, certainly the last two editions, which have featured the Chemin de Vigne, the vineyard tracks, they've been more memorable certainly than the previous 10 editions. And if sort of sprinters have grievances now about this, you know, an opportunity to land a big classic late in the season being denied to them, then it's kind of their fault, because for years they shunned it. You know, the best sprinters of their generation, the Cavendishes, the Kittles, the Greipels, they shunned Paris-Nice and never really showed it.
Paris-Tours,
and never really showed it the sort of the kind of respect or deference that the great classic riders had in the past. I think it's quite sort of promising the way this sort of new restyled Paris-Tours has started. You know, these first two editions. I mean, Strade Bianche is already, you know, after a decade and a half, it's kind of vaunted as this fantastic fixture, nearly monument in the cycling calendar. But that wasn't an instant hit, not to the extent that it is now. And I think there's definite potential for Paris-Tours in its current guise. And as you said, it looks absolutely fantastic. And, you know, I think if Sunday's race had been ridden on the more traditional course, you know, we wouldn't necessarily be here dedicating quite as much time to talking about it, because if you'll forgive the expression, it was really dying on the vine as a race. The quality of the field was sort of diminishing every year.
Well, partly that was because in 2008 it moved down from the top level Pro Tour, as it was called then, World Tour now, and so it isn't part of the World Tour now. So that undoubtedly has a big impact on the level of the field. But you're absolutely right, Daniel. It's just by the end of the afternoon, I couldn't help wishing I had a nice glass of Vouvray to go with it. I don't know why that was.
Well, of course, it's time of year when we wave goodbye to some riders, isn't it? Not that many big retirements this winter, but one notable one is Laurens ten Dam, who the CCC rider. It still seems strange saying that, because he moved across from Sunweb only this year, but he is retiring, and he's been a guy who's been interesting to follow, an interesting career, an interesting guy to speak to. And I think you did speak to him quite recently, Daniel, didn't you?
Well, it was actually a couple of years ago, Rich, but it was a sort of we talked about the whole of Laurens ten Dam's career, and he's always been a fairly unconventional rider, in the sense that he made no bones about the fact that the thing he enjoyed most about being a professional cyclist was the sort of adventure that were barbecues, and you know, how it gave him an outlet for this sort of adventurous spirit that he had. And, you know, there was a time in his career when he was enjoying quite a lot of success, when he was at the what was formerly the Rabobank team and is now Jumbo-Visma, and he finished ninth in the Tour de France in 2014. But this was actually what should have been the sort of pinnacle of Ten Dam's career, actually led into a pretty miserable year when, well, in his own words, he became a bit too sort of serious and forgot why he was in professional cycling in the first place. And we spoke about this a couple of years ago at the Sunweb launch. And we'll just hear a bit about that now. And also where his conception of cycling, and as I said, quite an unusual conception of cycling, where it came from in the first place.
So why I'm riding my bike, man? I started riding my bike really young. Actually, my first memory is riding a bike. I was lost. I was living next to the canal, and I was on my small Strider bike or something like that, and I was like, oh, where am I? And then I had the genius idea, just turn around and go the same way back, and I found the houseboat where we were living on back. But so this states already everything, you know. It's about adventuring, you know. When I was 11, 12 years old, I could go on a holiday in France. I bought an old Peugeot bike from the 70s together with my dad, and I went exploring alone from the campsite, me and my bike, and I was exploring France, and I could do 80 kilometers without my parents. There were no phones, nothing, just a small white paper with the names of the roads I had to take. You know, I was looking on a Michelin map before without GPS. You cannot imagine it right now, but that was how it was. It's all about exploring, and it's still like that, you know. I love to explore, and the social component is also a big part of it right now, you know. And when I meet my friends, we like to do first a night ride and then a barbecue and drink a beer. Or the thing was, I put too much pressure on the result for myself, you know. The 2 years before, I became 13th and 9th in the Tour de France, and I want to do even better, 6th, 5th. You know, I thought it was possible, but then I trained more, I dieted more, and I was more focused on the numbers, and I forgot how I did it the years before. I tried to do more, and then it all went backwards, and no results, no nothing. And then I got hit from a car from behind on the training ride just after the tour, broke my back, broke a lot of things, and I was like, fuck, you know, I don't like it anymore. And I told my wife, let's go to the US and race in a small team there or something like that. And that's what we did. So it was basically the accumulation of being too focused 1 year long, and having too much, because of the focus, there's also too much pressure and stuff like that, that I started to go back to where I started and explore new areas. And that was the whole area of Santa Cruz, California, where a lot of cycling started, because it's Keith Bonfrager is from there, Santa Cruz Bikes, I don't know, Giro. It's like, so I found like the founding place of mountain biking, which is actually really cool. And I did a lot of mountain biking there, and I explored gravel racing, a new segment I never did before. And now I'm also more into that, so I found new interests, and 3 years later I'm still racing.
So I thought that was quite sort of timely and pertinent, chaps, to hear that from Lawrence Tindam at the end of his career. And sure enough, you know, true to the way he's approached cycling over the past couple of years, I think he finished Tour of Lombardy on Saturday and got straight back on his bike and headed off with Sam Ooman, former teammate at Sunweb. And they're on some kind of jaunt, some kind of expedition heading towards Rome, I think, as we're recording this.
Well, it's good to hear Sam Ooman is back on his bike, because he had an iliac artery operation, didn't he, earlier this year? And it was a pretty serious operation after the Giro. So he's a very promising young talent. But Tindam, we should explain the barbecue reference. He has barbecued meat every night. Is that correct?
I think so. I think he has a barbecue every day, yeah. I think he claims to be the world record holder for consecutive barbecues.
Wow. I mean,
not very fashionable these days.
We should invite him to the penultimate stage of the Tour de France, from Lure to La Planche des Belles Filles, and see whether he fancied a bit of barbecued finger from the man at our guest house from a couple of years ago. Are we staying there again, Rich?
No.
Oh.
Oddly enough, a teammate and, I think, friend, a long-time teammate of Simon Geschke, who is one of the only vegan riders in the peloton.
Oh, I didn't know he was vegan. Mm. Ah, interesting. Right, well, should we wrap things up for this week? We seem to we're being invaded here, Lionel, by some children who are congregating in large numbers on the south bank. Quite threatening.
I thought you were going to say pigeons. They're
no.
Pretty threatening looking.
No, gangs of children are approaching. We should wrap things up. What you look like you're going to say something, Lionel?
Just on the food and wine at the tour. That's a really important business, Daniel. From a wine point of view, is it a good tour or an average vintage?
It's a decent vintage napalm in the sense that we spent a lot of time in the southeast. Not quite, I don't think, venturing into Côte du Rhône territory or Châteauneuf-du-Pape, but a lot of good wines in that area, sort of Privas, Sisteron as well. Unfortunately, we sort of bypass, by plane, I think, according to the map. Anyway, we bypass the whole of the Bordelais, the Bordeaux wine growing region, when we head up from Pau to the Ile de Ré. So that's a bit of a shame, I must admit.
I don't think we'll be bypassing it by plane though, will we?
No, we
Lionel.
Won't. We won't.
We'll be able to. That's, yeah, there's a nice rest day in La Rochelle if you just don't go. Ile de Ré, I think it's going to be difficult to stay on Ile de Ré, but you can have a nice couple of days on La Rochelle. Which I'm looking forward to immensely. We do go to Bourg-en-Bresse, but there's a stage start there, so it might be difficult to.
Are we not there the night before
chicken.
For the chicken?
No, because there's a big transfer up there from the previous day. I can't remember which stage that is, but it's quite a big drive up, so I'm not sure if we'll get any Bourg-en-Bresse chicken, I'm afraid. Lionel.
Well, that saves the controversy, doesn't it? I mean, I think we got the raw deal last time we were there. We didn't get raw chicken. We got cooked chicken, but we got a raw deal because I think they sensed there were a few chicken skeptics among our group that night.
We'll get back there at some point.
Well, we've got 7 or 8 months to digest the tour route, haven't we? So it's going to, well, as it always does, all roads lead to Nice in the first half of 2020. Plenty of time to talk about what the tour may or may not throw at us and throw at the riders.
Yes, we should wrap things up for this week. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
Just before we go this week, let's hear a little excerpt from our new episode of Service Course, which is out later this week, presented by Tom Wally and Lizzie Banks, the Bigla rider who, of course, won a stage of the Giro Rosa earlier this year. This episode is all about data bias and how that affects equipment, design, clothing, etc. It's absolutely fascinating, and it's out later this week.
We really are so used to seeing men as the default that most people aren't aware that they are ignoring women.
There are some things that, like, currently I'm really frustrated about, and it's exactly that it's based on men and not women.
We all vary, some shorter arms. I mean, I've just built a frame for a guy with achondroplasia, which is otherwise known as dwarfism, and that's all working out really well. But that's an example of a real outlier, and we're all around, really.
You are listening to Service Course by the Cycling Podcast, the stories behind the bikes.
Oh, what an amazing moment. You know, the crowds were kind of 10 deep all the way through Otley. And
with Tom Worley and Lizzie Banks.
It was just a spine-tingling moment, something that's never going to happen again in my career.